The aim of this lecture is to give you an overview of 18th century politics and the context in which it operates. I'm going to cover a large number of topics and very briefly, and it's really to give you an introduction to those topics rather than an in-depth analysis. The topics I'm going to study in this lecture include identity, war and empire, society, economy, the role of women in politics, and a brief historiographical overview. First, let's look at identity. At the beginning of this period, Britain exists only as a loose alliance of the three kingdoms of England, Scotland, and Ireland. By the end of the period, both Scotland and Ireland have been united with the Crown of England under successive acts of union. However, the three kingdoms continue to have different political institutions, social, legal, economic, and perhaps importantly, religious structures. The idea of Britishness, then, is something that's constructed during the 18th century. And Linda Colley, in her influential book Britons, has identified a number of characteristics that encourage this formation of a British identity. These include the impact of the various wars that are fought in the 18th century, the idea of the other, in particular France, that British identity is constructed against, the supremacy of the Protestant religion, the primacy of Parliament, the development of a bureaucracy, the reinvention of the monarchy from the divine right image at the beginning of the period to a popular constitutionalist monarchy by the end of the period, and the role of the aristocracy. The 18th century is certainly a period of war. There are almost constant wars throughout the period, ranging from the war with France following the Glorious Revolution to again wars with France at the end of the period following the French Revolution. This period also sees the growth of the British Empire, in particular the North American colonies, which were acquired and then lost during this period, colonies in the West Indies, and also the acquisition of India. The significance of these developments mean that, to some extent, Britain's identity is shaped by engagement in these wars. But more importantly, the country manages to remain solvent in spite of the wars, and this is due to what John Brewer has called the establishment of the fiscal military state. Thus, the wars were financed by an efficient use of indirect taxes. In addition, Britain had no expensive standing army to maintain. Instead, it relied on volunteers or press gang people into supplying labour for the army. Another factor is that many of the wars took place at sea, and thus there were no invasion threat until the Napoleonic Wars. And finally, Britain's colonies were important for the influx of luxury goods, which fueled the consumer revolution. As far as the social structure is concerned in this period, there are conflicting views of the importance that social changes had on the political order. J.C.D. Clarke, for example, has argued that after 1660, the English Ancien Régime remains intact until 1832. In comparison, the Whig Marxist tradition argue that new forces are compelling major changes in the distribution of power, and these are focused around the growth of the middle classes. So we need to consider whether the changes in society in this period consolidated and modernised the ruling order, or challenged it. There are a number of surveys during the 18th century which give us indications of the social structure of the period. The most important of these is Gregory King's Table of Ranks, Occupations and Professions of England. He estimated that 70% of the wealth of England and Wales was land-based in 1688. Another survey in the 1780s concludes that the figure was still around 60%, but within the landed sector, wealth was less evenly spread. The most important factor in the social structure, though, is the growth of the middling orders or the middle classes. The three most prolific sources of non-landed wealth in the 18th century were trade and finance, the professions and industry. The middle class colonised the new urban centres and were increasingly important factor in the political life of the period. For the poor, the 18th century was a time of struggle and change. In rural society, the enclosure movements forced small landless agricultural labours off the land. In urban areas, the labouring classes suffered because of the introduction of new technology and changes in working conditions. Wages remained low throughout the period, and the standard of living also remained low, but there were problems in times of high bread prices or crop failures. The social structure to some extent is shaped by economic developments over the period. We're familiar with the idea that industrialisation is an industrial revolution is an important event in this period towards the end of it. New economic historians, however, have argued that there was a smoother graph of evolutionary change rather than the sort of revolution which has previously been described by historians. There was a vast, sustained and unprecedented rise in population, but the new economic historians would argue that industrial growth took place over the whole century and that part of the revolution was a revolution in technology. If we move on to look at the role of women in politics, again, this can be seen as a period of change. The traditional view has emphasised the restrictions imposed on women. However, more recent historical analyses have emphasised women's agency and their enthusiasm for politics. There was a debate throughout the century about the proper role of women and political influence, and historians have argued that this either represented a move to exclude them from politics, or in Linda Colley's view, that female power and influence is becoming more potent and more effective during the period, and therefore there is a need to try and rationalise them out of the political arena. There are a number of ways in which women could contribute to politics, and just to give you a few examples, there are clearly influential aristocratic women within the court and within Parliament, both as royal favourites and mistresses, also political confidants, and a number of important women ran influential salons where political discussion was encouraged. They employed political patronage and were able to intervene in political issues in the period. Women could also play a role in parliamentary elections, both through their property owning, but also in canvassing. The famous example here is of the Duchess of Devonshire in the 1784 Westminster election, which by many is seen as the moment where women start to be excluded from that aspect of electoral politics. But this too is open to debate. For women of the middling and poor status, they too could get involved in election campaigns and in a number of influential political affairs during the early 19th century, such as Peterloo, the campaign for Queen Caroline, and of course parliamentary reform. I want to end this brief analysis then by looking at historiographical trends, and you can identify various interpretations of 18th century politics across the last couple of hundred years. Perhaps the most influential political school then are the Whig school of history. The Whigs focus on the role of ideas in history, particularly those of freedom, religious toleration and representative government. In general, they take a progressive view of society, but this is generally shaped by hindsight. They identify crucial episodes in the achievement of a sort of modern democratic state, from the Magna Carta in 1215, the Glorious Revolution of 1688, the 1832 Reform Act, and then going on through the 19th century, further reform acts which extend the franchise. You'll note in this that they tend to neglect the role of the 18th century in this period, seen as a hiatus between the Glorious Revolution and the Reform Act. The most famous example of Whig history is Thomas Macaulay's A History of England. The Whig view of history was challenged in the early 20th century by one of the most influential writers in this field, Sir Lewis Namier, who wrote two influential books, The Structure of Politics at the Accession of George III in 1929 and England in the Age of the American Revolution in 1930. To briefly summarise Namier's approach then, he puts the monarch at the centre of the political stage. He emphasises people rather than ideology or principles. He focuses on precise analyses of the interests of politicians, the composition of parliament, and the workings of patronage, but he is not interested in the motives or purposes of men in politics. And his work was particularly applied to the middle of the 18th century, the accession of George III, 1760s, although some of his followers extended his approach to the whole of the 18th century. Namier's views have been attacked by a number of historians. For a start, they challenge his view of the monarchy, arguing that the fortunes of the monarchy fluctuate during the period. They argue that his approach is irrelevant to periods outside the 1760s. They emphasise the importance of party and ideology rather than of men in politics. They challenge his view of the electorate, and they also see a role for those outside the formal political community, who Namier tended to ignore. A further influential school is that of Marxist historians, a group of radical scholars who were influenced by the work of E.P. Thompson, who wrote The Making of the English Working Class. These historians focused on the largely rural, unenfranchised masses. They also look at the embryonic working classes and produce vibrant social histories of 18th century Britain. However, like the Whig historians, the 18th century is something of an interlude in this analysis. Again, they're waiting for industrialisation, modernisation. In the 1980s, a new attack on the Whig orthodoxy appeared from what might be termed the New Right. These historians emphasise continuity rather than change. They put emphasis on the importance of religion rather than that of ideology, and look rather than at the power of the people, they look at the power of the establishment. these historians take a long view of the early modern, arguing that things like the English Civil War in 1688 are not the culmination of a concerted period of rebellion by all Englishmen, but rather 1688 represents a coup d'etat by an interested aristocratic faction. The most important book on this theme was published in 1985, J.C.D. Clarke's English Society. And finally, I just want to look briefly at the state of the art today. There's no central theme, but studies over the last 10 years have tended to stress the cultural context of 18th century politics. The urban setting has been re-examined, and rather than the 18th century being seen as a hiatus, instead it's seen as the beginning of radical politics, of challenges to the establishment. There have also been increased studies of British and English identities, both from historians looking at communities in Britain itself and those who are looking at the role of the empire in shaping these identities. There have been discussions of the representations of class and also the notion of the people and the popular. The debate then has moved on from the dichotomous arguments of progressive versus reactive, elite versus popular, ancien régime versus bourgeoisie, to stress the more complex and subtle variations of 18th century political life.